Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm talking to Sandra Eder, who is an assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the brand new book, How the Clinic Made Gender, The Medical History of a Transformative Idea, which is just out earlier this year from the University of Chicago Press. Sandra, welcome to the show.
Hi, Claire. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I started out as a gender scholar. I did my first degree in at the University of Vienna in history, where I wrote a BA thesis, Magister Phil thesis on lesbian pulp fiction, and I was really interested in the question of gender and sexualities. I then went to Columbia University to do an MA in American Studies, and it was there that I encountered Rebecca Jordan Young, who is a feminist science scholar, and she really inspired me to act that it would be actually possible as a historian to engage with scientific texts, with medical texts, to read sexological studies and to critically analyze and understand them. And this kind of led me to become a historian of medicine. I did my PhD at the Institute of the History of Medicine at the Johns Hopkins University. And there I worked with Nathaniel Comfort and then Todis on the history of medicine science. And then with the gender historians, Judith Walkowitz and Mary Ryan. And so in a way, I've always, I switched from a gender historian looking from the outside on medicine to a medical historian who's engaging with the ways in which medicine and science were involved in constructing and developing the ideas of gender and sexuality that so influence our lives.
And how did you come to write How the Clinic Made Gender? Was the book based on your PhD dissertation?
Yes, it was based on my PhD dissertation. I was really intrigued by the idea that gender or some form of gender concept was first formulated in the clinic, and in the 1950s, it seemed very contradictory to me. I really, and it's often in my work, I'm just, I think the desire to understand why, to ask why and how really inspired me to pursue this further. And it took it, and being at the history of medicine took it in a very different direction than I had first presumed. And so I wrote my dissertation on clinical encounters with intersex children at the Johns Hopkins Pediatric Endocrinology Clinic. And then over the years, as I developed it in the book, I just broadened the approach to kind of include the before and the after and the move beyond the just clinical space and bring the world into the clinic and the clinic into the world, if that makes any sense.
In the introduction to How the Clinic Made Gender, you write that the book's contribution, and this is sort of where you lay out the main argument, is, this is a quote, to show how convergent and multidisciplinary ideas about masculinity and femininity coalesced in the practices of those working in the pediatric endocrinology clinic at Johns Hopkins. And you go on to do this in the book by using patient records from the clinic. To reconstruct clinical encounters at the time when gender was first being formulated. I would love it if you could tell us about how you use patient records.
So for the book, I use patient records. I really wanted to use patient records for two related but slightly different reasons. And so one was that I was really interested and inspired by different praxeographic approaches to medicine, that is to look at how things, how ideas or concepts or treatments or identity come into being through doing something. So in the sense of the clinic, I was interested in not in polished medical reports, how that describe some discovery about how sex was determined, but actually how do they actually do it in the clinic? So to really embrace and look at the messiness and of the clinical encounter and to observe physicians and other medical practitioners at work in discovering the series, working through them, making mistakes, making errors, and figuring things out in a way. So that was one motivation. But I think the even stronger motivation was because, in a way, the book necessarily is... it's very focused on physicians' perspectives and ideas that are developed by physicians and by psychologists. I really wanted to engage with the voices and the experiences of the patients at the clinic. Now, as we know, patient records, despite what their name says, are really not often not a good source, especially modern ones, to discover quote unquote the kind of authentic voice of the patients, because they're highly mediated. The whatever the patient says is kind of forced into this pre-printed, pre-standardized formats. It's very much dominated by the ideas of the voices of the patients, the interns, the nurses, the social workers. So one of the challenges I felt, but was really important for me to overcome is to engage with that, especially with these records, which are pediatric records. So the patient in this record often is a small child, so they're silent in the record, and it's the family that speaks for them. And then they grow up and become more of a person in over the years, and that emerges in these files. And one of the things that I wanted to do is to create this space to hint at the stories of how these patients might have experienced these often jarring clinical encounters and these lives that were really mediated by medicine. And so in a way, I read against the grain, I looked at disruptions, I looked at small comments. So I really dug through all these hundreds and hundreds of pages to tease out these moments of resistance, of defiance, but also of cooperation, of seeking out the clinic as sometimes as partners against overprotective parents. And I wanted to account for that experience and put it in the book in an extra space that pushes against these other chapters that are very much, very often more focused on how physicians find out things and how they kind of create this particular knowledge about gender. So I want to kind of give a voice, not the voice, but a voice to the experience that these children and then teenagers and then young adults had in the clinical space.
And this, you do this just beautifully. It's just beautifully done, the way that you weave the patient's stories into the text, sort of between the main, more traditional historical chapters. It's really lovely. I'd like to turn our attention to those more traditional historical chapters where you're sort of building your argument and presenting us with the evidence. Let's start at the beginning with just some basic terminology. What's congenital adrenal hyperplasia? Is that abbreviated CAH?
Yes. So CAH is an inborn hyperplasia of the adrenal gland, which results in a lack of cortisol and an overproduction of a precursor of androgen. And that often causes life-threatening metabolic imbalances, such as salt loss in infants. So the severe form of this inborn condition can be life-threatening, but not all forms are. So some are not. And so the condition also often results in what is referred to as ambiguous or male-presenting genitalia in newborns, even in those whom the metabolic effects were not so severe. And this condition had long been known as adrenogenital syndrome, named after the most obvious sign, that is either male appearing genitals in double X chromosome children or sexual precocity in children with XY chromosomes.
And so this really the center of how the clinic made gender is the Johns Hopkins Pediatric Endocrinology Clinic. How was CAH treated by Lawson Wilkins at the Pediatric Endocrinology Clinic in the 1940s?
So it's important to know, as I said before, that the condition affects the whole body and may in some cases be life-threatening. Even so, often the reaction or the notice, the most noticeable effects were the kind of the effects on the children's genitals. But Wilkins comes across the first cases are actually boys with CAH, young patients who waste away in his clinic, die abruptly, and he's really interested in the kind of endocrinological aspects of the condition. So one of the first incentives for him to start his research program and to start treating is to actually find some kind of therapeutics for these children with severe cases who are most likely not to survive. And it's very frustrating and saddening to see these early cases where children just perish and despite all intervention. And Hampton Young, who was a urological expert, urological surgeon at Hopkins and the previous expert on CAH or adrenogenital syndrome, as he called it, had a surgical approach. So he removed the whole or parts of the adrenal gland, but all the children kind of wasted away and died after the treatment. And so what Wilkins does, he proposes an endocrinological approach. And he's looking for a substance that will combat the effects of the hyperplasia. And so he tried out different substances in the 1940s, which failed to show any promising results. But then in the 1950s, he started using the steroid hormone cortisone, whose therapeutic effects were first demonstrated in 1949. So the substance was then successful in keeping children with CAH alive. And so as this is happening, Wilkins is also asking the question how these children should live. Right, this concerned especially those with XX chromosomes and male-appearing genitals. So, for example, before cortisone was introduced, Wilkins actually thought that these children should be raised in the male sex. Even so, he saw them as females that would have female reproductive organs, but he favored social functionality for sex assignment rather than letting chromosomes or gonads dictate his decision. So for him, it's really the questions, how can they live? And it's a very unusual recommendation at the time because everybody would have kind of determined the sex of these children to be female. But what he's saying, and that's the interesting part about Wilkins' approach, because he's not a sexologist, he doesn't do that kind of research. He's really saying this out of a kind of clinical pragmatism and also the conviction that these girls with CAH could and should be raised as boys because they look male and they would not be able to fulfill their female roles, that is to get married and to have children. And so it's an interesting incident where we see how these kind of social concerns of health influence treatment recommendations and recommendations of care and assignment of sex in a very direct way.
And so how does Wilkins become, you call him a decisive figure in the transformation of sex and the formulation of what we today refer to as the sex gender binary? How does he become a decisive figure like this?
So for me, it was really, the focus on Wilkins was really important to decenter John Money a little bit, who's always been the prominent figure in the story and who's still a prominent figure in the book. But I think it was really to show there's a clinical continuity, like even before we have this formulation of gender that Money then later brings to the clinic, that we already have a practice of gender, the idea that children can be raised in a sex that is not the biological sex and fulfill this role, that this can be shaped. And this comes directly out of the clinic from somebody who does not, contrary to Money, engage with psychological theories or thinks about kind of cultural relativism or social theories. Is really something that emerges from the clinic and from a clinical pragmatism, the things of what can we do with these children? And it emerges from the idea that even if sex is more complicated and variant, these children still have to have a clearly defined binary sex so they can, you know, fulfill a social role. And I think I'll stop there.
Okay. Well, then the book does go on to get into psychological construction. So I wondered if you could explain the concept of psychological sex. It's sort of in contrast to anatomical sex, and how this concept was constructed.
So again, this leads us to kind of the prehistory of what happened at Hopkins in the 1950s. We can see in medical case reports starting in the 1930s and 1940s that practitioners increasingly relied on psychoanalysis and psychiatric analysis to determine what they now call psychological sex. And they reach also a conclusion in which they say, other than they might have previously argued, to argue that psychological sex is acquired in the course of growing up and it trumped anatomy. And this is really based on encounters with cases where psychological sex or the sex a person lives in or identifies as or whose behavior they manifest is disconnected or does not fit what they would describe as anatomical sex. And so this first forces people to actually really, so these are mainly cases that are concerned with teenagers or young adults. And there's where this discrepancy is discovered, and psychologists and psychiatrists try to make sense, who are involved in these cases, try to make sense of what to do with these cases, why these teenagers and young adults, even though they have a male biological sex in their assumptions, live convincingly, act convincingly, and feel very much as women. And so those who did these psychological evaluations see this strong, that these people have a strong identification with the sex they're already living in. And they often remarked how convincingly and consistently these young people enacted was then what they increasingly called psychological sex. So in a way, this category becomes important because there's a disconnect between, you know, anatomy, your anatomy kind of shapes your behavior, shapes your sexual, how you behave as a man and woman. If there's a discrepancy, you have to find a different way to name it. And so what they're saying is that psychological sex has to take into account that we cannot just look at a child and say this is biological sex, so the sex in which the person lives has to match it, but you have to test for psychological sex. Part of this has to do with a general secularization of American society that starts in the 1920s. So there's a much more attention to psychological effects of everyday life of individuals. But then there's also this move that this case is really, for me, reveal an implicit acknowledgement that psychological sex could differ from anatomical sex, as well as the assumption that the environment, social situation, upbringing, culture patterns could determine a person's psychological sex. So there's something that changes puts more focus on environment, on upbringing, and acknowledge a disconnect, a possible disconnect between anatomy and psychology.
And how do particular medical interventions enter the picture here?
Particular medical interventions, could you reformulate the question? I'm not sure.
To address this mismatch between psychological and anatomical sex, does this lead to particular kinds of medical interventions?
Oh, I understand. There's a close connection, as other scholars have shown as well, of course, to kind of innovation in medical technology and medical diagnostic practices on one hand. So I think certain kinds of things play an important role. I mean, anesthesia, antisepsis, all these things that started in the 19th century already allow different investigations or closer investigations of anatomical sex. But then there's also a move towards seeing the body increasingly after the 1920s and 1930s as malleable, as changeable. So you can actually then adjust. So if somebody has been living in the female sex, there are surgical and endocrinological technologies to adjust the body to the sex, so the body can be manipulated in many different ways. And I think that's it's not quite what you asked, but I think I'll stop there.
Sure. You mentioned John Money. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about him. Who is John Money, and how do you understand his earlier work as a behavioral scientist in the 1940s and 1950s?
So John Money is really a curious figure in this history, in the history of an inception of gender, especially in the second half of the 20th century, because he's become such a larger-than-life figure, and he's being cast as, you know, either, and I say that in my book, as a well-intended innovator, but also kind of as this evil experimenting mad scientist, especially with the case of David Reimer. And he, And it really depends on who tells the story. And so in a way, I'm doing exactly what you're asking in the book. I'm kind of taking it back to this moment in the 1940s and 1950s where he is becoming a psychologist, a social scientist, where he is this young New Zealander who went to the United States to be able to pursue graduate studies in psychology at Harvard University's newly founded Department of Social Relations. And so I'm interested kind of what are the different ideas and different practices that he can draw on that making actually less of an eccentric, but more of a typical manifestations of the different social and scientific approaches to sexuality at the time. And so one of these interests in, for example, cultural, he was really interested in culture patterns and the role of the environment in shaping behavior. And that's, of course, a product of the previous three decades in which social scientists convincingly and passionately really argued for the culture and environment trump biology as determining factors in behavior. So that's one of the influences that's there. And then the other important factor, I think, that shows us a very typical of what's happening in the behavioral and psychological science at the moment is really that as he's transitioning from being this kind of New Zealand graduate student to a US psychologist at a very prominent medical campus, there's this moment, also this profound shift in the behavioral science, where there's an increasing insistence on social determination and also the belief in that importance that it's really important to foster and right kinds of behavior to child development and child rearing. So there's a shift from, you know, all cultures are equal valid after Second World War to this moment, this Cold War moment, where it's really, well, we want to make sure that our children become, you know, democratic citizens, that we have a particular kind of well-functioning American children that we decide to have as our as future citizens. And so there's a shift towards manipulating, there's a possibility of manipulating and determining behavior rather than just observing its differences. And I think it just enters this moment where this kind of social determination of behavior becomes really important. And we see that in the way he pursues his studies, both at Harvard in his dissertation that he writes on what he calls hermaphroditism, and then his work at Hopkins.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So can tell us a little bit more about that work at Hopkins. Tell us about the research that John Money does with Joan and John Hampson in Lawson Wilkins Clinic.
So, and this is another instance where Lawson Wilkins is really important, because he's been, when he started treating children's with CAH with cortisone, he decides that he needs to have a psychological evaluation of their healthiness and what to do. Should they reassign the kids that have already been raised as so the double X chromosome children who've been raised as males, should they reassign them as women, as girls? And so that's one of the questions he's facing. And what kind of intervention is warranted? And that's why he hires Jomani, who's just graduating at this time from Harvard. And he's already been working with Joan Hampson, who's a psychiatrist in the neighboring Phipps Clinic. And then her husband, John Hampson, joins the team later. And so the team is then funded to do this long-term study over the course of 3 years to evaluate the psychological healthiness of first only CAH patients who are treated with cortisone, but then they expanded as the question expands to the question of how should they live and how to find the correct sex for these patients. It expands to a whole array of different patients with intersex traits. So it goes beyond the small group of CAH patients. And what Money and Hampson do is to kind of create these rosters where they separate anatomical sex in multiple categories, from gonads, hormonal sex, chromosomal sex, genital sex, and so on. And then they pose these categories next to the category of social sex, the sex assigned at birth that the children are already living in. And then what are they measuring? And this is where Money comes up with the term gender role. So he comes up with gender role as a new term for psychological sex, even so it is really beyond it. It's more behavioral, but he comes up with the term to create this measurable category. And in the study, they compare anatomical sex categories to and social sex to the gender role that the child has, that they study in conversations, in observations, also ask the child how they identify. And their conclusion is, what they come to is that in most of the cases that encounter, the gender role of the child matches the social sex, the sex in which the child is raised and in which is currently living, despite often very obvious biological contradictions. And so they create these kind of rosters, very visible, very crude, but very, very on the eye, where they can show like this different, how social sex always correlates with gender role. And so that leads them then to the recommendation that actually, to a certain extent, any sex can be assigned to these children with intersex traits. We don't have to go by any biological categories. We could assign any sex to these children, but it has to be early, it has to be consistently, and it has to be, in a way, anatomically enforced. So by that, I mean that they argue that there is, that's really important that neither the child nor the parents have any doubts about any about the sex assignment. And for this, it's really important, and that's where the body comes in again, that the body of the child at least visually matches the assigned sex. So there's a focus on genitals, and very invasive and problematic early surgery, genital surgery, to adjust the genitals to the assigned sex. And then the focus also later on puberty, kind of to make sure that no doubts arise in the child or their parents. So that leads them not only to this recommendation that, you know, in a way, any sex, but one, you know, one of two has to be assigned, but also the whole kind of search of a treatment regime that's very invasive, that's very, has long-term consequences on the sexual and social well-being of these children who are operated on at an age where they obviously can't consent. So there's this mixing between this concept, which seemingly seemed seemingly kind of very revolutionary at the time, to step away from these biological categories, that you can learn your sex, you can learn your gender role, but at the same time, there's an insistence on kind of the social norms of sex, that it has to be clearly distinguished. It can be either or. There's not a concept of just gender non-binary or letting these children over term finding out for themselves. And the reason for that is also that they claim, based on their findings of a very small group, that there's a critical phase. There's a critical phase of 18 months to 2 years in which the kind of gender role is formed. And then this kind of fluid thing that you can just assign becomes indelibly fixed. So he kind of never says really how. The kind of like he refers to Conrad Lorenz and imprinting. Of course, Conrad Lorenz used imprinting and critical faces. It kind of triggers very differently. But he says it's basically you have this gender role is enacted in encounters with the environment, but after a certain phase is fixed, and then you cannot change it anymore because it's going to create psychological unhealthiness in these children.
And so how does this concept of gender role, how does it evolve into gender identity?
So Money and the Hampsons publish a set of papers in between 1955 and 1956. And then the Hampsons leave the clinic, go somewhere else, they have a big falling out. It's a rather dramatic story based on Money's diaries. But then Money continues the work. And so what he has, and he, behind him, because he offers this solution, this kind of pragmatic solution for clinicians to apply to the treatment for children with intersex trait, and it comes from Hopkins, a place that has a lot of prominence among medical experts, it carries a lot of weight, and people are listening to it and following the story and taking up those treatment recommendations in textbooks and in different sites. But then psychologists also take this new term and, you know, change it and play with it and adapt it to their own specific needs. And the most prominent in this case is the Californian psychologist Robert Stoller, who was one of the first ones to take up the notion of gender and adapt it to his research priorities. And so one of his contributions to the scholarship was the differentiation between a person's conception of self, so gender identity, so that's a term that he introduces, and the behavioral manifestation of gender and gender role. And Money, of course, would have disagreed and said, like, all of these are in gender role, right? This is not something, gender role is kind of this body-mind concept, and it's kind of this fused, you can't really tell where body and mind end, and you can't separate it like that. But he grudgingly takes up this new formulation after a while as well. And so Stoller says that gender identity kind of describes the sense of knowing to which sex, so like intuitive knowing to which sex you one belongs, and kind of this awareness whether one is, would say, I'm male or I'm female. And what it also allows is that because gender identity refers to the self-image and this kind of disrupts it from differentiates it from behavioral manifestations such as gender role, it allows a broader variety of experiences in a way. So a patient could say, as Stoller formulates it, he could say, I'm a man, but I'm not a very masculine man, if that makes sense. So it's like that their gender identity is male, but they kind of recognize that they're not very masculine, so their gender role is slightly different. And so this opens up a lot of spaces for including different kind of gender experiences. And Stoller publishes in 1968, the book Sex and Gender, which seems to be the first American book, I think, where the word gender appears in the title in a non-chromatic meaning. And so it gets a lot of traction, and actually a lot of people pick up gender first to Stoller and then kind of come back to the data that money provides with the studies, because that's one of the things that Hopkins and money has, is because of the unique position of Hopkins. They have the patient data. They have so many patients of a very relatively rare condition come to the clinic that it really gives them a certain kind of power to say, we actually can talk about these cases with some kind of authority.
Yeah. What is the Hopkins Gender Identity Clinic?
So that actually comes later, and it's often it's important to note that money's engagement with gender first happens at the pediatric endocrinology clinic under Wilkins, as you mentioned earlier. And so John and John Hampson leave, and Money stays at Hopkins and kind of becomes more prominent and more connected in the clinic. And so there are two things that happen. One is that starting in the 1950s, there's a public and medical interest in individuals who feel the strong desire to what they call change their sex and live in a sex other than their biological one. And that has been steadily increasing. And so once practitioners who work on or like study such individuals or work with them, increasingly start using, by the mid-1960s, start using gender identity as well. And then Money is also increasingly interested in what is called kind of transsexuality at the time, but through this nature, he even tries to coin his own term called contra-sexism. And so as he's part of a network of psychological practitioners who are studying and treating transgender individuals, and many patients are referred to him, he decides he wants to have a gender identity clinic at Hopkins. That is a clinic that is really concerned with this specific group of transgender, or he calls them transsexual patients. So it's a very different space than the clinic, the pediatric endocrinology clinic. And so he becomes involved around 1965 in this project to install the gender identity clinic, or a research unit, a clinic and a research unit at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, and to involve members from different subspecialties such as psychiatrists, plastic surgeons, gynecologists, urologists, and endocrinologists to bring all these people together. And it's significant because even though that's not the first clinic that's called Gender Identity Clinic, the first one is actually at UCLA and established by Stoller 4 years earlier, but it's the first one where they are planning to actually perform what was then called sex change operations and what we would now call gender affirming care. And so even so, Hopkins in actuality performed very few such procedures. It was very cumbersome to get selected, and it was very expensive, as I understand it. It makes waves because it's the first prominent research hospital where such operations kind of take place on American soil. And so they get a lot of attraction, a lot of attention for this.
The subtitle of the book is The Medical History of a Transformative Idea. And your book ends by talking about the relevance of this history you tell to theorists and scholars of women's and gender studies. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, about why and how is this medical history relevant to people thinking about gender today?
I think that's a great question. And I actually think about this a lot and in ever-evolving ways. And it's really important to note that there's an ongoing struggle about kind of who owns the idea of gender and who may instill it and kind of define its implications and what it means. And we can see this most obviously, I think it's most obvious in this, you know, the different ways gender is used today. I mean, from what is called now gender reveal parties, which are actually just celebration, you know, like celebrations of the kind of the revealing of a child's genital sex as it's observable in a sonogram, or kind of this this fear that gender as a category carries radical implications that, you know, we now have recently seen expressed in new legislation and heated debates about public bathroom usage and kind of the oppression of many of transgender individuals in certain states. And so what I wanted to show with the book is kind of to go back to this the ever-evolving category and really point out that A, gender was and is a dynamic category, and it really, we're not always talking about the same thing. It changes over time what it means in specific contexts, and it really, it's really meant to solve and describe various relationships between nature and nurture and biology and culture, but it's not consistent over the place. So often we might talk about gender from different perspectives, but we might talk about something completely different. So there's something about this. And then the other thing I really wanted to point out is to look at this history and to acknowledge that gender in its conceptions and births at the clinic was an inherently normative concept. So the gender, sex gender binary that's developed at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in the 1950s proposes this idea that gender role is learned and relatively independent of biology, but it's nonetheless real for them. And so there are social implications with that. It's not only becomes, do they claim that gender identity becomes fixed, but it's also imprinted, but there are also these cultural norms of masculinity and femininity that then enforced, imposed even more and even more strictly on these individuals, and in the long run, on all of us, right? And so it was really interesting for me to point out that as feminist activists and scholars kind of take up this idea of gender, they really, I mean, they've been talking about sex roles and kind of the social construction of femininity, masculinity for a long time. But what I wanted to show also is that they make gender their own in very shortly. So it's very quickly that feminists point out that that these ideas of gender that the idea of gender as it is enacted at Hopkins is really very normative, very stereotypical, and they just flip it and say, well, if gender role is learned, then we can also unlearn it, we can challenge it. So they kind of take this idea and make it their own and run with it. And then the other thing that I found really intriguing, and I think it's really important to know, is that, and again, it connects to the idea that gender is a dynamic category. I was really intrigued with this, the way in which queer communities take gender and use it strategically, change its meaning, use it for all kinds of typical challenging, use it in a way to challenge stereotypical assessment of the social norms of masculinity and femininity. So the kind of queering gender in a very interested way. And to show all these legacies, I think, was really important for me to point to the power that we have in defining and redefining this category, and the power that is invested, you know, by in gender as something that can be commercialized, but at the same time can also be seen as really disruptive and dangerous to social norms. And I think the awareness of these stories, I thought it was really important to go to these origins and to kind of see the consequences that different formulations of gender have for different people, the consequences it has for people with intersex traits, the consequences it has for, and kind of the different ways in which it's taken up in the often, again, very normative treatment of transgender individuals within the medical apparatus, which forces certain kind of gender norms on them that are actually not shared by many transgender individuals of the time, but have to be performed in order to get the kind of medical interventions that they're seeking. So I wanted to show the kind of the messiness and the dynamic nature of this category that is... that requires different meanings in different settings.
Well, that certainly comes across in the book. And it is a fascinating, fascinating history of a concept. We've taken up a lot of your time, and I have reached my traditional final question here at the New Books Network. And that is, what are you working on next?
Well, thank you for the question. That's a tricky one. That's much harder to answer. So actually, I'm working on multiple projects. One is kind of some aspects of this story that didn't go into the book. So I'm working on a study of how in the 1970s, this category of the transsexual patient is constructed. And I'm also working on how a lot of transgender individuals take and change the category of sex and the category of gender and the interpretation gender in their own interaction. So I'm looking a lot of, so that's one of the things I wanted to pursue a little that I'm hinting at in the last chapter, and I wanted to take a little bit further in my research. And then the other project is tentatively entitled The Science of Happiness, and it's looking at the ways in which happiness is measured in medical encounters and used as treatment goal and assessment of treatment success, both in the cases that have to do with sexuality and gender and sex assignment, but also in a much broader context.
Wow, well, those sound like fascinating projects. Sandra, I want to thank you so much for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.